This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
And so your mother was really ahead of her time in a sense.
Yes, she was. Very, very definitely. I mean, autism is a very big spectrum. At one end of the spectrum, you got famous artists. I think Van Gogh had a lot of autistic traits. You got Einstein, who had no speech until age 3. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got people that remain nonverbal that are extremely handicapped. So you've got this word, autism, that covers a very, very large spectrum. And I get very concerned about the kids that are more like me, sort of not getting their abilities developed. And, you know, people on the spectrum, and this is another chapter of the Autistic Brain book, tend to have uneven skills. Good at one thing, bad at something else. Like, I was really super good at art. Another kid may be good at math but have problems with reading. Another kid's good at writing. We've got to build up on the thing that they're good at so they can turn it into a career.
So that seems like a really intuitive approach, but a lot of times people actually do the opposite. They focus on shoring up the deficiencies rather than focusing on the strengths. And well, you give a good example of one of your teachers who you really admired but also made this mistake.
Well, yeah, he bashed away on algebra when we should have gone to geometry and trig, because there's a lot of visual thinkers that can't do algebra, but they can do geometry and trig. Now, I'm not suggesting that we totally do nothing for deficit. You know, we have to do something. But, you know, we tend to just whack away at the deficits and not do anything to build up the strength. I've heard sad cases where a child was doing badly in math, and so they took away band practice so he could do an extra period of math. Well, band practice is the thing the kid loved and made school worthwhile to him. You don't take away band practice.
And you talk a lot in the Autistic Brain also about the dangers of labels. And obviously this is a complex label, the label of autism, since, as you mentioned, it really is an umbrella for a whole bunch of different scenarios and subtypes. Tell us a little bit more about some of the dangers you've seen when people get a label like autism.
Well, you see, get on the real mild end of the spectrum, you know, where I've seen kids a lot milder than me, kind of just smart, geeky, kind of socially awkward kids. They sometimes sort of become the label. They don't get stretched enough. You know, when I was a young child, you know, I had to have table manners. I had to learn how to buy things in a store and talk to the clerks appropriately. You got to stretch these kids. But there's one thing we do have to make some accommodations for, and that's some of the sensory problems. There are some individuals that absolutely can't tolerate fluorescent lights. They can see the flicker. There's other individuals that have horrible problems with sound sensitivity, and sometimes that can be desensitized if the child initiates the sound. In the Autistic Brain, you've got a whole bunch of tips on how to deal with the sensory issues. And if there's one place where we need to have research, it's on sensory. Now, the thing is, sensory problems are very variable. You know, they range from being a nuisance to being very debilitating. You see, and I think there needs to be, you know, on sensory stuff, we need to be diagnosing specifically what is the child's problem. Does he have a problem with fluorescent lights? Does he have a problem with seeing the print jiggle on the page? A problem with loud noise? Problems with touch sensitivity? I still can't stand scratchy clothes against my skin.
One of the things that I found really fascinating in the book was the fact that scientists are really focused on observing behaviors of people who are autistic rather than valuing and asking for the actual subjective experience of people with autism. And it seems like that's the key to really solving some of these sensory issues, is to get more self-reporting of people who are actually autistic.
Well, you see, and when you have individuals that are nonverbal, and there are a few individuals that are nonverbal that can type totally independently, and the one is Tito Macapetahe, and another one is Carly Fleischman, and they're profiled in the book, The Autistic Brain. They live in a totally sensory disordered world, you know, where their visual system's pixelating like a bad TV with a satellite shaking, you know, satellite dish is shaking. Problems with the hearing is cutting in and out like a really bad mobile phone. I think those writings of people like that are really important for understanding some of these sensory problems. Then you can start to figure out what brain systems may be involved.
And you bring up the point in the book around how two very different behaviors might be coming from the same subjective experience. So someone who's very withdrawn and non-communicative and someone who's very frenetic and maybe hyperactive could both be responding differently to the experience of overstimulation.
Well, yeah, you can have two ways you can respond to overstimulation. You know, you have certain individuals, you take them into a large, busy supermarket, and they're having a big meltdown, throwing a big fit, and because it's sensory overload, you can have other situations where they just shut down and become totally non-responsive. But in both situations, it's sensory overload.
Which might give some cues to ways we could do interventions from a medicine perspective as well, I would guess.
But in order to do interventions, we shouldn't be diagnosing them strictly as autistic. You've got to figure out what sensory processing problem do they have. In fact, fortunately, in this version of the DSM, they did mention sensory problems as being, you know, some of the potential symptoms. But if you want to find treatments for sensory problems, you've got to find subjects that all have the same sensory problem. Otherwise, you're mixing up apples and oranges and grapes, and you're not going to get very far if you do that.
And then you talk about some of these subsets of sensory problems, like Erlen syndrome, where people are overstimulated by the actual white page, which is making people have difficulty reading, but it's not because they couldn't read, it's because of actual color contrast.
Well, and what happens in that situation, these are the individuals that hate fluorescent lights. They can see the flicker of fluorescent lights, and they'll see the print jiggle on the page. And I find in my livestock handling class, and the students have to do drawings for my class, I find 1 out of 50 in my class has this problem, because these students absolutely cannot draw a circle. You know, they just draw scribbles. And I ask them what they're seeing. They say they kind of see waves. And this can often be helped with colored glasses. You can find just the right pale colored glasses. And it's going to be different for each person. They got to pick out the pale glasses that will work for them. Like one person may be pale pinks or pale lavenders. Another thing that can help with reading is try printing the book on different pastel papers, like gray, tan, light blue, light yellow, light green, and try experimenting with different colored backgrounds on the computer. And some people like just the regular old white-gray Kindle because that reduces the contrast. Some people with Erlen syndrome just love the old-fashioned type of Kindle. That's really good. But the person has to find out what works for them. Also, the old-type TV screens are terrible, absolutely terrible. You want to be using tablets and laptops. Those are your good screens.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Health Watch, and we're talking today with Temple Grandin about her latest book, The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum. Temple, what are your thoughts on the autism epidemic? Do you believe that the epidemic is a real phenomenon, or is it an issue of us still struggling to define the terms?
I think on the milder end of the spectrum, it's just increased detection, it's increased diagnosis, because I can remember people I went to school with. They're all gray hairs like me now. And they would be diagnosed in today's school system. I think there is some severe autism that may have increased. You've got older parents now, which especially in dads leads to more copying errors in the genetics, some environmental contaminants. Also, medications taken right at conception in the early first trimester. Another factor could be deficiencies in B vitamins. There's interesting studies on folic acid and other things in B vitamins that are really crucial right around the time of conception and in the first trimester.
Have you seen the studies on fever during pregnancy? I know that there's some association with schizophrenia and a little bit with autism around protracted fevers. If somebody gets the flu, it increases their risk slightly of getting schizophrenia autism.
That's right, and that's mainly in the first trimester because that's when things are really, really delicate.
That's interesting. One of the other things in the autistic brain that I really enjoyed was you take us through your own personal experience as a test subject, and you've had your brain scanned for different experiments for many decades now. Can you tell us a little bit about your thoughts on brain scanning and what you've learned?
Well, I learned some interesting things. Learned why I can't do math. My left parietal area is full of cerebral spinal fluid. I've got asymmetry, and also found out why. Might be a good visual thinker. Those circuits are enlarged. In fact, if you want to see the most fabulous scan, you can go and look up USA Today, Temple Grandin, and they got one of the best scans in there. That's like my gigantic visual search engine. See, what's happened is my language circuit for speak what I see has reduced bandwidth, and I had trouble getting my language out. And then I had all these branches that grew all around the whole brain, which sort of gives me a visual search engine. Now, I want to emphasize, not everybody with autism has this. Other kinds of minds, like the mathematical thinker, and they're not going to have any, their parietal cortex is not going to be full of cerebral fluid. What tends to happen in autism is to get uneven skills, good at one thing, bad at something else, but you can have different skills that you can be uneven in. Now, the trait that seems to be universal, at least on the high end of the spectrum, are the social deficits, face recognition, picking up subtle social cues. Those circuits tend to not be be normal.
So you have the quote, don't ignore deficits, accommodate them. Don't ignore strengths, exploit them. Can you talk further about some of the strengths of the autistic brain? And I know that's not going to apply to all people with autism.
Well, not, you know, you see, I'm a visual thinker, and so the work that I've done with livestock, actually the field called industrial design, where you, you know, it's the art side of designing things. I'm very good at that. Then it's another kind of mind, the mathematical pattern thinker, and this person's going to be good at computer programming and engineering. And we need to have these two kinds of minds to work together. Because if you take a product like the iPad, for example, Steve Jobs, who I'm pretty sure was on the spectrum, along with Einstein, no language until age three, he was the artist, and he thought up the user interface. And then the engineers have to make it work. Now, the thing that worries me with all this emphasis now on STEM courses and math is us visual thinkers like me are going to get screened out of the sciences. But you need me, because the reason why the Fukushima nuclear power plant blew up was because they made a visual thinking mistake I could never make. I can't design a nuclear reactor, but there's no way when I live next to the sea, I'm going to put super important emergency generators that run the emergency cooling pumps in a non-waterproof basement.
That's a good point.
Because when the tsunami came in there, the generators drowned, and along with electric wiring and everything, and that's why four reactors burned up.
And when you talk about the collaboration around different thinking types, which obviously is also true for people who aren't autistic, you also have mentioned your collaboration with your co-writer on this book and how you have different thinking types that have made this book be what it is.
Well, that's right, because, I mean, Richard, you know, Richard's really gifted science writer, and one thing he's done is organization, and he did some very heavy lifting on the genetics chapter, just, reviewing the literature, and then he had to, we did long interviews, and kind of sort the stuff out, then I'd go through, and okay, now what are the really important journal articles that show that there really is two kinds of visual thinking. There is the art pictorial visual thinking like me, and then there's the visual spatial, where is an object in space? That's the mathematics mind. And I had kind of figured out these different kinds of minds on my own, but then when working on the book, I found scientific articles and studies that show that these different kinds of minds actually exist. So there's like five references on that we absolutely have to have in there.
That's great. And really, the science of brain imaging and the differences in brains is in its infancy for the most part, wouldn't you say?
Well, there's some great new technology now, high definition diffusion tensor imaging that was developed by Walter Snyder at the University of Pittsburgh. And this can dissect out the white fiber cable bundles that connect up the different departments of the brain. And this technology's got tremendous potential, but it's sort of like getting this new telescope that's just come out in the last two or three years. But now people have to learn how to use it. And the technology was originally paid for by the Defense Department for head injuries. But the Defense Department's not going to pay for autism research. Now we got to do research to find out how to use the technology. But I think what's going to happen as you start to use it is that certain parts of autism are going to get divided up into subgroups.
And has there been any research on the plasticity of the brain, of the ability of the brain to change as we exploit our strengths and shore up our weaknesses?
Well, yeah, the brain definitely has got plasticity. I was just reading something the other day that hippocampus gets larger and kids that get math practice. But kind of problem I got is the circuits. Some of the circuits I think are just not there. You know, you can't, you know, you got to have something there. Like my language, I couldn't get my language out because I probably only have about a fourth of the bandwidth I'd normally have for the speak what I see circuit. But, you know, they worked hard on me on language therapy, and I've got language. But you see, there was still circuit there. It wasn't like missing.
Sure. And so over time, with you being a test subject, have you've seen changes in your brain scans as you've become more of a public?
No, I haven't. No, we haven't done enough brain scans to plot changes. We haven't even done it. No, I've not done that.
And you talk a little bit about the 10,000 hour rule that's been made famous by Malcolm Gladwell. Tell us about the misinterpretation of the 10,000 hour rule when
I agree with practice, you know, and the whole thing where people are like best of the profession when they're 10 years into it. Yeah, that would be true for me with drawing and design, very definitely. I also agree with Malcolm Gladwell that in order to have a talent, you got to have access to the art materials or access to, you know, the resources. But where I don't agree is innate ability does matter, and it especially matters on the more extreme ends of the spectrum. Because Bill Gates and I had access to the exact same IBM teletype computer in 1968, state-of-the-art, went into the big mainframe with the reels that spin around, and you typed on this teletype, and I took the programming course. I couldn't do it. I had free time on this computer. I had all the instruction I would have wanted. I just could not do it. And Bill Gates was phenomenal at it. So we had access to the exact same computer, and trying to take the programming course, it was just hopeless.
Yes, and you, the DSM-5 is coming out soon. And
It's already out.
And tell us a little bit about your thoughts about where it's gone and whether it has any usefulness, really, when it comes to autism and the autism spectrum.
Well, the thing is that they've, you know, taken out, a lot of people are upset about taking out Asperger's because that's become like a kind of a form of identity. You know, people go, And basically, it changed the Asperger's to social communication disorder. So if you were to use the DSM-5 really strictly, there'd be some people that would not be in the autism spectrum. And I think the reasoning behind this has to do with money and access to services. Now, one good thing is they did put in there that sensory problems can be one of the symptoms. That's actually was good. You know, see, the problem is that it's behavioral profile. You know, they try to change all the time, but there's a certain amount of opinion that goes into behavioral profiles. You know, you've got science, but then you also have opinion. It, you know, what people need to realize is that they are behavioral profiles, and they're not accurate the same way a tuberculosis diagnosis is accurate. You do a lab test, they go, yes, you have tuberculosis. It's definite.
And at the very end of the autistic brain, you talk about employment, and you talk about the three thinking types or the three thinking subtypes in autism and different employment possibilities for the three types. Can you expand a little bit about those?
Yeah, very definitely. The pictorial visual type of thinker like me would be good at industrial designing, graphic design, art, animation, architecture, photography, anything you know, has to do with making pictures. Probably be good on things like hardware design, because that's where you have to I'm sorry about this wagon going by.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah, you have to work strictly working with pictures. And then the mathematical mind, they're going to be good at things like computer programming, engineering, anything to do with mathematical stuff. And then the word thinker tends to be very good at detail, very good memory. In fact, all types of autism have extremely good memory. And one place where word thinker would be really good would be specialty retail, because, boy, they would know every little bit of merchandise.
Are you still there, Temple?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. So in the employment section also, you give some advice to people with autism who are entering the workforce. And a couple of the things you say is, don't make excuses. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, boss needs to really, to be direct. There's a scene in the HBO movie where my boss slammed down a deodorant and said, "You stink, use it." You got to be direct. If it's something wrong, you can't sort of say, "Well, you're too enthusiastic." When you talk to customers in the store, you need to demonstrate to them exactly how they should behave. Like you might say something like, "Well, watch how Susie interacts with customers," and then do it the way Susie does it. So you've got to give really clear instructions. You cannot be vague. Tell them, and they need to have they need to know what the project is. One thing I like about designing things is, okay, I got a deadline, and I know what the I'll handle the design, but I know the outcome of what the customer wants.
And how about some final thoughts for our listeners today? I'm sure we have some parents out there who might have a child who just received an autism diagnosis, for instance.
Well, if it's a 2 or 3 year old child and you have no speech, don't wait. The worst thing you can do with a young kid like that is to do nothing. You've got to start working with that kid, interacting with them. You got to work with them. Now you get on the more less severe end of the spectrum, develop strengths. Another thing is teaching work skills. I'm seeing a lot of problems where kids are going through college and then they don't want to work because every job, no matter how good it is, has got a certain amount of grunt work. And they need to, kids need to learn that discipline of work. When I was 13, my mother got me a sewing job. And when I was 15, I was cleaning horse stalls and I was doing carpentry work and painting signs and selling them. And I was in college. I had career-related internships. There's a discipline of work. I was out at my aunt's ranch, and volunteer work does count. And let's look at, I know the paper routes are gone, but dog walking would be a good job for a 12-year-old. And you got to walk Mrs. Jones's dog every day. Working in a farmer's market would be a great job for some of these kids on weekends. And they're going to have to be there even when it's raining and it's nasty. They're going to have to be there. There's a discipline to having a job. And the younger kids will just have to set it up in the informal economy.
Well, Temple, it was really a fascinating read, The Autistic Brain. I found it interesting both on a narrative level and on a scientific level. And I appreciate you being on Health Watch today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
We are talking today with Temple Grandin, the author of The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum. I'll be back again next week with the author of The Book of Woe, who's going to talk about the controversy around the latest psychiatric DSM-4-5 manual. Stay tuned for the rest of the Monday Morning Radio Zine. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host.
Dance companies and orchestras around the world are giving centenary performances of Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring. Here in Portland, new choreography to Stravinsky's score will be performed by the Agnieszka Laska dancers in collaboration with the PSU Orchestra, under the direction of Ken Selden. Live in Lincoln Hall on June 7th at 8 p.m., it's the centenary celebration of Stravinsky's masterpiece, bringing Portland into the worldwide honor of The Rite of Spring, which is considered to be the most iconic performing arts achievement of the 20th century. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, the Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Gary Greenberg. Gary is a therapist and author. He is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. He's written for the Rolling Stone, New Yorker, New York Times, and he's also the author of Manufacturing Depression. His new book is called The Book of Woe, The DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. So welcome to Madness Radio, Gary Greenberg.
Well, hi, it's good to be here.
It's really good to have you here. And Gary, you were actually interviewed a few years ago before the Manufacturing Depression book came out. And so if people want to check out that interview archived at the Madness Radio website, I encourage people to do that. Well, you went pretty far down the rabbit hole of the DSM. How did you, because, I mean, your work is getting, I mean, it's great to see your work is really getting out there. Manufacturing Depression is a great book, and you've been getting a lot of coverage, a lot of mainstream media play. And how did you end up writing the book that is really encapsulating where the DSM struggle for the DSM-5 is, the Book of Woe? How did you end up writing that book?
The easy answer to that question is that I wrote a magazine article for Wired about the DSM about 3 years ago, when the wars that the psychiatrists were fighting over the DSM-5 were just beginning to heat up. That article was called The Book of Woe, just like my book is, and the editor who assigned it was a guy from Harper's, and Harper's was a magazine in which I had an article that became the book about depression, Manufacturing Depression. And in that article, I spent some time at Harvard Medical School as a subject in a clinical trial. I was guinea pigging it. And thankfully, my clinical trial did not involve real psychotropic drugs. It involved fish oil. And actually, as it turned out, I was on the placebo anyway. In any event, the surprising part of that trial to me was that I originally signed up for a trial of minor depression. But the intake interview conducted by a psychiatrist, in the intake interview, he concluded that I had major depression. And not that I'd ever been a big fan of the DSM. As a clinician, I've been using it forever and always thought it's like a colonoscopy. It's one of those unpleasant things you have to put yourself through in the case of the DSM in order to help people use their insurance to pay for therapy. But as I was getting interviewed by this doctor, I realized he was asking me questions keyed to the criteria in the DSM, but he wasn't really paying any attention to me. And not only did I find that personally insulting, but as a clinician, I wondered, how can you do this? How can you simply attend to the criteria and not attend to the patient?
How did he do that exactly, Gary? What was it that he was doing?
He gave me a test called the SCID. And the SCID is a diagnostic inventory keyed to the DSM criteria. And it's very simple. Like the major criterion for depression is, for major depressive disorder, is sadness that lasts for 2 weeks. At least 2 weeks. So the question that's key to that is, have you been sad for 2 weeks? It's not rocket science. It is a checkbox. It's a troubleshooting chart. They go down, and if you answer no, then they skip to page 26. And if you answer yes, then they go to the next item. And it covers the full SCID, covers the entire DSM. And theoretically, if you spend the hour with the person doing it, you can come out with a DSM diagnosis. So he was paying more attention to the paperwork than he was to me. And in the end, he concluded that I had major depressive disorder. Now, this was a very strange thing because I had gotten myself the 90 miles to Boston. I had shown up. I was my usual charming, funny self. I was clear that I was there partly as to do research myself, that is to write an article about this. I was engaging. I wasn't somebody that if I was in his chair, I would have thought had major depressive disorder. But according to the DSM, at least according to the tests he was giving me, key to the DSM, I did have major depressive disorder. And that sort of focused my interest on how this book actually got put together and how it's used, remembering that the DSM, it's not only a convenience for therapists and people who want to use their insurance, it determines what drugs get approved, It determines courtroom questions like whether or not somebody is incompetent to stand trial. It determines commitments, and that is to say the kind that have to do with mental health. It's used in school districts to determine who's eligible for special services. It's a hugely important book. And so the question of how it gets put together and who puts it together and what their interests are is more than just of, you know, some kind of scholarly value. It's a question of public health and public policy.
You describe the DSM as to psychiatrists what the Bible is to Christians.
It was not my idea to call the DSM the Bible of psychiatry, and it's actually in some ways true. It's true in the sense that it's the foundational text. It's true in the sense that it's also like the Constitution is to the United States. It's the book that gives the institution its authority. Unlike the Constitution and unlike the Bible, the authority of the DSM comes not from God and not from, you know, the founding fathers. It comes from, at least presumably, from science. The modern DSM was psychiatry's attempt to rescue itself from a terrible crisis, which they found themselves embedded in the beginning of the 1970s. And so sort of consciously created it as the cornerstone of the profession.
So what was that crisis? Was that kind of the transition from Freudian psychoanalysis and that kind of approach to psychological problems and treatment to a more clinical or more scientific claiming approach? Is that what it was?
The crisis in psychiatry was caused in part by some embarrassing studies that showed that psychiatrists, given the same patient, would disagree about what mental illness they had more often than they would agree. So that was one problem. And that was sort of an in-house problem that bothered psychiatrists. But then David Rosenhan did his famous On Being Sane in Insane Places, which was the study showing that, you know, in which graduate students showed up at emergency rooms complaining that they were hearing the word thud in their heads and were promptly admitted, all of them, to different hospitals with diagnoses of schizophrenia. And in some cases had trouble getting back out of the hospital, even though they never did anything more to indicate mental illness. And that study made a big splash. And then in 1973, after years of protest by activists, the APA, American Psychiatric Association, voted to delete homosexuality from the DSM, which was then in its second edition.